Well, thank you, David, for that very nice introduction. It's my first time at the Kavli, only my second time in Santa Barbara, and I've been made most welcome, in fact, so welcome that you've even laid on the right weather for somebody from Britain to come today. So it's very nice to see you all here this evening. I'm going to talk about great ideas of biology. Even I'm not presumptuous enough to talk about the great ideas of biology, but I'm going to talk about great ideas of biology. And I'm going to focus on the history and philosophy of those ideas and how they interact one with the other. On the whole, biologists tend not to talk so much about great ideas and grand theories. We sort of differ from physicists in this respect, I have to say. We tend to be more comfortable with little things, with details and particulars. What we biologists like to do, we like to do things like list the numbers of species in a habitat, or count the numbers of hairs on a beetle's leg, or what we tend to do today is sequence genes, but it's much the same sort of thing. It's to do with details and particulars. But I don't think quite enough emphasis is given on to the great ideas of biology, and I'm going to choose four this evening, really not much to do with my own work at all, but four great ideas which I think are important, and I'm going to indicate a fifth which maybe not everybody would agree with, but which I think will be potentially of interest as a great idea in the coming years. And as I said, I'm going to focus on where those ideas came from. So I'm going to, it'll be quite an historical talk, but having said that, it'll focus on the ideas and what supported them, as well as the characters. So this is my, we have the wrong talk. I need assistance. I should have looked behind me. Can you find the other one, please? That was Rockefeller University. It's very nice. I'll talk briefly about that. We now have a starry night. But it's the great ideas jib. This is for tomorrow. There we are. Very good. Down here, maybe. Very good. Well done. Thank you very much. So, the great ideas, and my first idea, which we, I think many biologists would agree with, is the cell as the basic unit of life. This is easily stated, very easily stated. All life is composed of cells, and the cell is the simplest unit exhibiting the characteristics of life. In a sense, cell is life's atom. It's the basic unit of life. And there's two parts to that idea. One is structural, that it's the basic structural unit, and the second is that it's also the basic functional unit, and you'll see what I mean by that in a few minutes. Now, this idea started in the 17th century, and it took nearly 200 years to come to full maturity. And as is often the case in science, it was technology that begat discovery. And in this particular instance, it was the invention of the microscope, and it was the use of the microscope by a Robert Hooke, who did this particular work whilst he was mostly residing in Oxford. The microscope was invented in Holland in the early 17th century, and Robert Hooke turned it to biological material, producing a wonderful book in 1665, of which this is an illustration. And what he did here was to take a slice of plant tissue. It was from a cork, and he looked at it under a microscope, and he drew what you see there on the left, the black and white picture. I put on the right there a modern scanning electron microscope picture. And he saw these sort of boxes, and he called them cells because they reminded him of a monastery, of the cells that monks lived in, and that name has stuck. Robert Hooke was an interesting man. He was the what I like to call the experimentalist for the Royal Society. The Royal Society was full of gentlemen. Actually, it still is quite a lot of gentlemen there. And by gentlemen, I mean individuals who not always are doing much work. And Robert Hooke was hired by the Royal Society to do work and to actually present the experiments to the gentlemen. And he really actually started the society off in a very good way in respect for experiments. So these were the first pictures of cells. But as is also often the case in science, once somebody has made a discovery, everybody makes that discovery. Look at the crudeness of Hooke's drawing there. Look, only about 12 years later, you'll see this is Nehemiah Grew, who also was in England. He was an MD. And this is a picture of a vine stem. And this, I have to say, would be of a quality, that one on the left there, that you would have seen in botanical textbooks 30, 40 years ago. It's completely extraordinary. Have a scanning EM again on the right. But once again, you can see all the cells that make up a plant. In addition, within a few years of this, Leeuwenhoek, who was a draper living in Delft in Holland, discovered single-celled organisms, microorganisms. He called them animalcules, and this is a picture of a manuscript which he submitted to the Royal Society in around the 1670s, 1680s. And what he did is he scratched in between his teeth and put it under a microscope, which in this case was a single lens microscope, did a magnification of about 250, and he drew what he saw, which were bacteria, and you see them here, particularly charming. Look at fig B there, where it's clear that the bacteria did a sort of loop the loop under the microscope as he was watching it. And this is the first description of a single-celled organism, in this case, of course, a bacteria. There is a picture of Leeuwenhoek. It's not absolutely certain it's of him. But I'm going to show you another picture, because Leeuwenhoek lived in Delft, and he was the executor of Vermeer. Vermeer, who may be familiar with you as a painter of the same time. Vermeer died in his 40s, and Leeuwenhoek was executor for him. And unusually for a 17th century painter, he did two portraits of a scientist, a geographer and an astronomer. This is the one from the Louvre, and I like to think this might be actually based on Leeuwenhoek. There's incidentally not one jot of evidence in favour of what I just said there, but I think it's a nice idea, and it's a nice picture too, so I thought I would show that. Now, over the subsequent 100 years or thereabouts, there wasn't so much progress, but better microscopes were prepared, which reduced chromatic aberrations, better histology, that is preparing plant and then animal material, and these improved techniques allowed cells to be essentially identified everywhere in living organisms, including, of course, in animals, starting with blood and then on to more and more complicated tissues. So, by the first half of the 19th century, Theodor Schwann and Schleiden, a zoologist and botanist, following on actually from Dalton, who was described atoms, this is within a couple of decades of Dalton describing atoms, proposed, as you see here in this sentence, we have seen that all organisms are composed of essentially like parts, namely of cells. He wrote in German, this is of course an English translation. So this is the statement that the cell is the basic structural unit of life. It took a little later, another couple of decades, and the founder of pathology, Rudolf Virchow, who was actually also a German politician, so scientists can mix with politicians. I'll say a little bit more about how that can be unfortunate a little later in my talk. But this is Rudolf Virchow, and he identified the second part of the cell theory, which is that it's the basic functional unit. In this sentence here, in 1858, every animal appears as a sum of vital units, each of which bears in itself the complete characteristics of life. That's identifying the cell as the basic functional unit of life. Now, this is a major milestone in biology. It's one that isn't actually sufficiently recognized, in my view. Several of the other ideas I will talk about are recognized, but this one isn't. But it's very important to recognize that the cell underpins all reproduction of every living thing, and also underpins the development of every living organism. It's also a subject that I just had to give an advertisement that Rockefeller University played quite a role with a number of Nobel Prizes in this particular area in the last few decades. But a cell which undergoes cleavage to form an embryo, and if you look here, you can see this is a mammalian embryo, and those little dots, each of those represents a cell. If I fail to impress you with the importance of cells, I'm going to try once more with this picture here. This is a picture of a mammalian egg just about to be fertilized. You see all these sperm around it. And I'll remind every one of you in this room once looked like this. Every one of you was once a single cell. Every one of you looked like this. And if I haven't interested you now, I do have to give up. I mean, that's the best I can do. So this is a very important idea. It's the basic unit of life, as I've said, underpins all reproduction and development, and is still in the news today. I mean, every other day, I mean, in the New York Times just today, you're reading about stem cells and what it means, and it means for the development of an organism, and also, of course, for clinical application. So it's a very important idea, and that's the first one that I want to bring to your attention. The second idea is one that will be more familiar with you, and to you, and that is the gene as the basis of heredity. Now, from ancient times, it was observed that particular characteristics are passed down from generation to generation, from parents to offspring. Aristotle noted that, for example. But the question was, what was the basis of this heredity? Now, this was a problem that was of great interest to the plant breeders of the 19th century, who were trying to improve plants and were experimenting by crossing plants to do that, and of course were interested in the whole issue of heredity. So what they were doing was crossing plants with different characteristics and then trying to see how those characters were inherited in subsequent generations. Now, whilst quite a number of investigators were doing this type of experiment, it was actually quite complicated, because quite often characters seem to become blended in the next generation. Sometimes characters disappeared, and then when they would cross into the next generation, those characters would reappear again. And it became really quite confusing, and not too much progress was being made. But the situation was saved by Gregor Mendel. Gregor Mendel was a monk in what we now know as the Czech Republic. It's in Brno. And he worked in a monastery, an order of monks which had a particular interest in science. And the monks would specialize in different areas. He was trained as a physicist. He didn't do very well in his traditional training. And he was going to be a school teacher in physics, but he didn't do too well in his exams. But he was an experimentalist. He had a telescope. He looked at the moon, did drawings of the moon. He was a meteorologist. But he also became interested in plant breeding. And he applied a different approach to the experiment. And there's three reasons, because I'm going to explain to you in a moment why he was successful. There were three reasons, I think, for his success. The first thing he did was to choose material that he could understand. Now, what I mean by that is biology is quite complicated. And quite often, principles can be lost and masked by the complexity of a particular system that you're choosing to study. And it may be that the basic principles are only easily revealed in experiment if the situation or the system is simpler. And what he did was to take half a dozen different plant species and do trial crosses. And what he next did, some would say, was cheating. He threw five of them away because he couldn't understand them. He threw them away and focused on one plant, the pea, I shall show you it in a moment, which he could understand. Choosing the right biological material is very important for solving a problem. Once you've got the principles, you can then apply the principles to more complex situations. If you start with the complex situation, you can't sort out the basic principles. Second thing that he did was to record accurately what he observed, and to count what he observed. And I tend to think this may have reflected his physical training. Biologists, certainly at that time, tended not to be quantitative. They would describe, they'd be qualitative, but they tended not to count. He counted the progeny, and what emerged there was very discrete ratios, and it was from those ratios that he could then formulate hypotheses that he could test. And that was the third characteristic that he had. He generated theories or laws based on his observations and tested them. And that was also a little unusual for biologists. Many of you will be familiar with the famous 3-to-1 ratio that Mendel identified. Mendel wasn't the only one to do that, and I think it may surprise many in the audience, because it certainly surprised me when I discovered it only a year ago, that Charles Darwin, who we shall talk about a little later, also did crosses with plants. He crossed with snapdragons to each other. He also observed the 3-to-1 ratio. It's published in a book he published in 1868, but he took it no further. He did not generate a hypothesis, he did not generate a law that he then tested. Well, Mendel did all of those things, and he had actually quite a big research laboratory. I acted for a while as a trustee for Mendel's monastery preserve it. And I took this is a photograph that I acquired when I was there. This was his garden, his experimental garden, and he had a greenhouse next to it, which is no longer there, of about the same size. I mean, these are significant laboratory resources. And this was, of course, provided by the Catholic Church. That was the research funder of the time. So, what did he do, and what was the what model did he then produce? I don't this evening have enough time to go through this, which is actually a very nice idea. But he studied, first of all, the pea. This is the pea that you see here. And he chose the pea in part because he had varieties, strains, which would cross with each other, with very clear characteristic, very different phenotypes, as we'd say. So tall plants and short plants and different coloured seeds and different coloured flowers, allowing him to follow very clearly certain characteristics. And then what he did was essentially propose a particulate theory of heredity. And the reason he did this is because he observed these very simple ratios of characteristics, 3-to-1, 1-to-1, 1-to-2-to-1. And that made him think of particles and combinatorial series. I mean, it was a much more mathematical way of thinking about the problem. So he proposed that particles were being passed on from one generation to another, and that these particles were important in determining the characters that he then observed. And there's sort of two concepts there. One is a particle which is unchanging, and the second concept, which isn't emphasized in his paper but is implicit, is that the particle encoded information. And information is crucial here because it's important for heredity. He then proposed that in each organism, each plant that you see here, there are two particles that are important for each characteristic. Two particles there, but only one of those is passed on in the gametes when you produce the pollen or the eggs for the next generation. And on fertilization, on pollination and fertilization, you get one of those particles from each of the two parental plants forming once again the two particles that are important for that character. And finally, he proposed that one particle might dominate over the other in determining a particular character. And if you put all those ideas together, then you can explain what happened. If you took this is a typical cross, for example, a yellow versus a green seed. The first generation produced just yellow because it was dominant over green. You then cross that and out pops green again. And these can all be explained by particles segregating in the way that we've described. But prior to Mendel, it was just mysterious. Post-Mendel, it all made sense. It was a brilliant piece of abstract reasoning, completely right, but nobody took one bit of notice of it at all. He published it in 1865 in a journal that was sort of fairly well read by biologists at the time. He's mentioned in the Encyclopedia Britannica in the 1880s, so people were aware of it, but nobody took any notice of what he was saying. Until it was rediscovered 35 years later, at the beginning of the 20th century, by three groups of plant breeders who all rediscovered exactly the same ratios. The first one tried to publish without reference to Mendel. Scientists don't change, I have to say. Tried to do it, but was caught by the second one, okay, who obviously, because they weren't first, thought they would reveal the fact that that Mendel had already described. So they all referred to Mendel, but they all basically got the same idea. Now, it is interesting, why did nobody take any notice in 1865, and everybody took notice, because this was the start of genetics, in 1901 and the subsequent decades? Well, nobody completely knows this, but I'm going to offer you a thought about that, which is what happened between 1865 and 1900 was the discovery of chromosomes. Here's a picture I've taken from a squash of an onion root, and you'll see in there the threads that were described by the cytologists at the time. We're now going back to cells, of course, and these threads appeared at cell division, and biologists started to speculate that these might be the basis for heredity, because these were sort of clearly being divided in an equal sort of way every time a cell underwent division. And then a zoologist called Van Beneden was looking at the chromosomes in a nematode worm, a very small worm. And this is once again another example of having good material, because Van Beneden was looking at a nematode that only had four chromosomes, easily counted. If you look at the onion here, there's a lot of chromosomes, difficult to see what's happening, especially if your microscope isn't very good. Looking here, you have four chromosomes. When he looked at the gametes produced by this nematode, he saw there were only two chromosomes in each gamete. And that was because when the organism produces the gamete, it undergoes meiosis, and it reduces the numbers of chromosomes from a 2N to 1N, which is half the numbers. This is exactly the behavior, of course, that Mendel had predicted with his abstract reasoning, talking about the particles, which we now would understand as genes. So why I think so much notice was taken 10 years later than this is because the abstract reasoning of Mendel and his successors was being supported by concrete observation. And so that gave it a much sort of stronger feel. It was no longer just abstraction. It was abstraction plus observation and experiment that made it feel better. Once again, this is just my idea, but it sort of rings true to me. So this is very, very important that the gene is the basis of heredity. If I was to ask all of you what you would immediately think of if I say gene to you, you will say DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, which occurred 50 years later. Just to say, it's a story well known. I'll spend very little time on this. It did start, however, at Rockefeller University, so I do have to mention that. In 1944, Avery and his colleagues discovered transformation of pneumococcus. They were interested in different strains of the pneumococcus bacterium and transformed the phenotype of one bacterium into another by extracting DNA out of one form and sprinkling it onto the other form, and therefore transformed the heredity through the chemical of deoxyribonucleic acid. Not an observation that was well accepted. It was fought strongly by other biochemists, most strongly by other biochemists at Rockefeller University, by the way. Just shows you how good your colleagues often are. But it was eventually accepted, and of course, subsequently used by Watson, Crick, Franklin, and Wilkins for generating the structure. I wanted to say, I went to Rockefeller in 2000. 2003, and in my sort of welcoming cocktail party, a little old man came up to me to shake my hands, and he didn't speak very clearly, and I asked him his name again, and he said his name was McCarthy, and I said, this is 2003, and I said, you're not the McCarthy, are you? And he said, yes, I am the McCarthy. And what I was surprised is I was taught this in the 1960s, and I thought he was dead then, and to meet him in 2003 was completely extraordinary. He was a wonderful man. He was then in his 90s and was still attending seminars, still reviewing papers. Extraordinary. Very, very nice man, and part of the trio Avery, McLeod and McCarthy. Well, you're all familiar with the double helix of DNA. I'm going to say a little bit more about it later. You'll have read Jim Watson's books, many of you, I'm sure. We now know that chromosomes, which carry hereditary, are made up of DNA. We also know, largely due to Francis Crick and of course others, that DNA is transcribed into RNA, and the sequence of RNA, it determines that its translation into protein, which is a string of amino acids related to the string of nucleotides, and the string of amino acids determines the characteristics of proteins, which then fold up in particular ways to generate proteins with different properties, which in turn are important for generating the phenotype. And in five sentences there, I think I summed up molecular biology. But it had its origins in Mendel, and it went through Avery and Co., and then through all the molecular biology revolution, and of course is one of the greatest discoveries of the 20th century biology. So this is my second idea, the gene, the basis of heredity. It gives us an explanation of the genotype and how that generates the phenotype, and of course is also still relevant today, has enormous implications for what we are today, and the question of whether we're a consequence of nature and nurture, it is of course both, and it's a balance between them both, but it's a very important issue for understanding what we are and how we should think about ourselves. So it's an extremely important idea, and I think clearly is one of the great ideas of biology. My third idea would be, is the one which, if you went to a Borders, I've seen a Borders in town, and you went to the popular science book shelves, you'll see two topics. One will be string theory, and the second topic will be evolution by natural selection. And you'd think in biology that's almost the only topic there. There are so many popular books there. So this is, for many, the greatest idea in biology. It's a very powerful, very beautiful idea, and it is central to all biology. It has two parts. The first part is that life evolves. It's not fixed, it evolves, and it changes over time. And what that reflects is that there is a tree of life with all organisms related by descent. So that's the first part of the idea. The second idea is that a major mechanism, not necessarily the only mechanism, but the major mechanism for evolution is natural selection. And I'm going to talk about both of these. Now, these two ideas are usually associated with the man on the right here, Charles Darwin. But in fact, the first of them, that is, that life evolves, was absolutely not Charles's idea. It was an idea that had been around for a very long time before and had been discussed by many naturalists in the 18th century, like Lamarck, particularly, say, in France. But I want to talk about another Englishman, the man on the left there, called Erasmus Darwin, because Erasmus Darwin was Charles Darwin's grandfather and was an altogether more interesting and irascible character. So I just want to spend a minute or two talking about Erasmus before moving on to Charles. So Erasmus was a doctor in the late 18th century. He lived in the Midlands in England, in Lichfield and Derby. He was a member of the so-called Lunar Society, which was a collection of scientists and engineers who used to meet once a month under the full moon, so they could ride back after their meeting in light, and maybe after they'd had too much wine, I'm sure, as well. They had the nickname the Lunatics, I'm sure, because of this lunar cycle. And Erasmus was very important for that society, also included James Watt of the steam engine and Wedgwood, for example, of the pottery. He was very fat, very charming, and a great conversationalist, despite having a very extreme stutter. He was a very sociable character. He was so fat that he cut out an oval in his dining room table so that he could sit closer to his food. And that table I've seen, actually, in his house. He was famous as a doctor. George III, you know, the one that lost this colony, remember that one? George III wanted him as his personal physician, but he was a bit of a Republican and didn't want to... a Republican with a small R, I should say, who didn't want to serve with the king. He charged according to income. Like most doctors at the time, he didn't actually cure many people, but he had one very good characteristic as a doctor, which is he often could tell you if you were going to die or not. And whilst that didn't seem very helpful, it was actually rather helpful because the individual could put their house in order, and you didn't want necessarily to do that too early, if you get my drift. So I think that was one of the reasons he was he's very popular. He was a proponent of female education and set up two of his daughters, who were illegitimate, as teachers in a all-girls school, and wrote a book as to what the girls should learn, the first public school for girls in England. And as well as being a scientist and a doctor, he was a poet, and wrote all his science in verse. I mean, you can see why I'm bringing him up to you, because he's such an extraordinary character. So do read about him. And I have a couple of the first editions of his work, and it's all written in verse. It's just, it's completely hilarious, I have to say. He argued that life evolved. He didn't produce very much evidence for it. He put a motto on his coach, which was everything, it was in Latin, but translated was everything from shells. If you open up a shell, a mollusk is formless, sort of blob. And he was trying to argue that all complex life evolved from this sort of formless lump. And he was was arguing that all life was related. It wasn't popular with the local cathedral, and the Dean of Lichfield Cathedral, where he was, complained, and he had to paint out his motto because he was losing his rich patients. So this was Erasmus, and he was part of the tradition. As I've said, there was a very strong tradition in France as well, particularly with Lamarck, that life evolved. But it was his grandson, Charles, the man on the right, who gathered the information and the observation and the argument which supported that idea that life evolved, and also came up with a mechanism for it. And Charles did that based on observation, and that's very important to science. It's not... enough just to have a good idea. You have to get the supporting evidence of observation and experiment to back it up. And that was the difference between Erasmus and Charles. Charles, of course, is familiar to many of you. He went on this famous Beagle trip. It's, you know, we've had almost too much of Darwin last year. Came back to England after his five-year trip, never left again, settled as a country gentleman in Down Kent, that's near London, writing The Origin of Species in 1859. And in that book, he drew one illustration, this is shown here, which is the first tree of life that was ever drawn. And this, of course, illustrates the concept that life evolves and changes from early progenitor forms to a variety of forms, some of which have gone extinct, as he showed from the fossil record, some of which still survive today. So that was the first part, that life evolves. The second part was that natural selection is a major mechanism for that evolutionary process. And Darwin came to that idea from many observations and arguments, including artificial breeding of pigeons. He became a pigeon breeder, which was a sort of working class occupation at the time, to show that if you artificially selected, then you could change the form of a species, and therefore if you did it by natural selection perhaps that would work as well. And naturally he looked at the beaks of the finches that he saw in the Galapagos, and that's the drawings on the left there. I put on the right here a series of pincers which are all evolved, if you like, for doing, or perhaps designed, for different purposes, just to illustrate what was going on. Well, just to say something about natural selection, because even this was not actually only Charles's idea. Alfred Wallace, which was another English naturalist working in what we now know as Indonesia, actually came up with the same idea in a 20-30 page paper, sent it to Darwin to get his view of it. Extraordinary. And Darwin and Wallace both put papers in 1858 to the Linnaean Society describing this idea. Actually, Wallace had no idea that was happening because he was stuck out in the Far East. But that's what Hooker and other Darwin's friends did. And the year later, in 1859, Darwin published The Origin of Species. But in fact, both of these were also anticipated by a tree grower called Patrick Matthew, and again, this may surprise you, who wrote a book on naval timber in 1831 and proposed in a paragraph the idea of natural selection. He didn't take it anywhere. He didn't interpret it in the way that Darwin did, in a grandiose way to describe speciation. Didn't provide any evidence for it, but the idea was there. So even if you dig into this, it's not simply associated with Charles, but what is associated with him is the support he gave for it. So what is this idea? Well, the idea is simply stated. I'm going to very quickly go through the arguments here. The idea of natural selection is that within a species or a population of organisms, there are variants, which mean that you have differences. And these variants are due to inheritable differences, due to the genes, in fact, as I was just telling you. Now, those variants which are most successful, and by most successful we mean reproduce more successfully, those that are more successful pass on more of their genes to the next generation of that population. So as a consequence of that, you shift the population in particular directions, selecting for the fittest. The survival of the fittest is not Darwin's term, it was Spencer's, Herbert Spencer's, but it's a good description of it. Over time, the changes in gene composition that would give rise to gradually leads into changes in the characteristics of the population, eventually speciation, where a species undergoes divergence, and that leads to evolution. So that's the idea of evolution by natural selection. Now, I want to repeat what I just told you in a slightly different way to link it to the two ideas that I've already described to you, the idea of the cell and the idea of the gene. This is an argument that I first read about by Müller in the middle of the last century. Müller defined life in terms of evolution by natural selection. What he said was, living things have properties which allow them to undergo natural selection and therefore to evolve. He was using, if you like, a functional definition of life rather than a physical one. When people generally think about what is life, they talk about the chemicals that make life up. What this did is focused on what he saw as the salient point about life, which is evolution by natural selection. So what he argued was, for an organism to evolve by natural selection, it must have the following properties. Life must reproduce. Secondly, life must have a hereditary system whereby information which defines the characteristics of an organism is inherited during that reproductive process, that's handing on the genes. And thirdly, the hereditary system must exhibit variability upon which selection can work. So that's a statement of the characteristics. Now look at a reproduction of a cell. Here I've just schematized. There we have a cell, basic unit of life. Within the cell, we have genes, the basic unit of heredity. That cell divides. During and the chromosomes, the genes, determine the properties of those cells. One of them, let's say the one on the right, has some variability, which means it has a red coat. So what happens is that one generation later, you have two sorts of cells, some which are yellow, some which are red. If red cells are at a reproductive advantage for some reason, then this will eventually take over the population and you'll get evolution. Evolution by natural selection. Now, what I've put together there is three ideas, you'll see. One idea is the idea of the cell, the second is of the gene, and once you've got those two, you automatically, if you get some variability in the genes, get evolution by natural selection. And the reason I wanted to point that out is that often you don't link these ideas, but if you put two of the ideas together, the third naturally falls out. So this is the third most important idea. This is Charles Darwin as we tend to know him when he became the sort of prophet. And he finished with this beautiful sentence, you know, at the end of The Origin of Species. Whilst this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed law of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved, which is the last in the last paragraph of The Origin of Species. I think he was really trying to link himself again to the physicists. You know, the laws, he saw his law is on the same level as the law of gravity of Newton. And he wanted to sort of make that particular link. So evolution by natural selection. All life evolves and is related by descent. And natural selection, major mechanism. Once again, something that we can never escape from the media. I mean, we are always arguing about whether evolution by natural selection should be taught in schools. But it's also important for other issues. Kin selection, an idea produced initially by Bill Hamilton and others, that is that if you're interested in passing your genes on to the next generation, it's more efficient if you were to sacrifice yourself for more than two of your siblings, because then you will pass on more genes through your siblings. Okay, that's the basis of kin selection, and that forms a potential basis for altruistic behavior, because it means then that you would want simply by this sort of argument to protect and sacrifice yourself for your kin. So that's something we have to think about in thinking about altruism and morality. The fourth point is one that I like to emphasize, and this is to do with the tree of life. If we are all, every one of us here, related to every other living thing on this planet, then in a sense, should we not be stewards for our relatives? I mean, it's an argument about the biosphere and why we should try and defend and protect the biosphere. We're looking after our relatives. So this is the third idea, evolution by natural selection. Now, this gives us an insight into life, but it's what I call a sort of historical explanation of life, and it doesn't actually give us a sense of how life itself works. And that leads us to the fourth idea, which is life as chemistry. And this idea is that chemistry and physics are the mechanistic basis of life. Now, this isn't an idea that most people would squabble with today, but it was one that had to be fought for. Starting again with Aristotle, it was thought that living things were fundamentally different in what they were made up and how they worked, and in some way they are different in the way that they work, but fundamentally different from non-living things, to the point where normal physics, laws of physics and chemistry did not apply to living organisms. And this notion of which was called vitalism really carried on to the middle of the 19th century. Now, central to this idea is that there are chemical changes that occur in living organisms that are important for how living organisms work. Now, where did this idea came from? Well, this was an idea that had its origins mostly in France, because it had its birth with an interest and study of fermentation. And as we know, the French are very like fermentation. They're very good at wine and so on. And so it's a crucial part of French culture. And a number of important French scientists played a role here. The first is possibly the most famous chemist of all time, Lavoisier. This is a painting by David, which is in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. It's a beautiful painting. It used to hang in the president's office of Rockefeller University, actually. It used to belong to the university. But during one of our, you know, recurring financial crises, we had to sell it to make the budget meet. And it went to the Metropolitan, which frankly is the better place for it. So much as I'd like to look at it every day, I think it is better in the Metropolitan. So here's Lavoisier with his assistant, who was his wife. Now, what Lavoisier, working with Laplace, actually, another famous scientist who we think more of in terms of the generation of the solar system, for example, amongst many other things, they, in the 1780s, compared the burning of charcoal and of candles with respiration of guinea pigs. And what they actually showed was that a guinea pig respiring and a piece of charcoal burning produced the same amount of heat and the same amount of carbon dioxide. And observing that similarity made them think that respiration was like a slow burning candle. And that in turn made them think and to state that vital processes in life are chemical reactions. Brilliant. I mean, just brilliant. Because not obvious, but a brilliant step forward. But unfortunately, Lavoisier couldn't follow this up long enough because, as well as being a great chemist and scientist, he was also a tax collector. And here we see another picture of Lavoisier, but at the top right you'll see the guillotine. Because in the French Revolution, which he incidentally supported, in the French Revolution, he lost his head because he was a tax collector, and you could make quite a good living being a tax collector because you took a certain percentage. And he was executed in 1794. Now, a defense was made for him because he was a supporter of the revolution, and he also made, of course, many scientific advances. I want to read you what the judge said. The judge said that the Republic, that's the French Republic, has no need of chemists and savants. The Republic has no need of chemists and savants. That's why I said we have to be careful about politicians when you're a scientist. So this held things up. But it was taken up again by another great French scientist, this time Louis Pasteur, who in 1850s, also studying fermentation, but this time sugar beet fermentation, demonstrated that living microbes are responsible for the chemical transformations that you see in fermentation. He was looking, and was asked to do so by an industrialist, as to why the manufacture of alcohol out of sugar beet fermentation sometimes went wrong. And it went wrong because the wrong microbe was in there carrying out the chemical transformations. And so this was like an applied scientific project. I just want to make that point because sometimes, you know, we scientists keep going on about basic science and applied science. Here was a straightforward applied project, which when you thought about it, generated a profound basic insight. And what he showed was that, quite simply, that when fermentations went bad and made acid, they had bacteria in them, and when they were good and made alcohol, they had yeast in them. And that made him think that different microbes were carrying out different chemical reactions. So he could solve the problem for the industrialists, that was good, but then he took it the next step. He generalized that. And what he concluded was that fermentation was a physiological act yielding chemical products necessary for the cell, the microbes, cells. And such chemical reactions are an expression of the life of the cell. So he took the Lavoisier one step forward and argued that the basis of life was in fact chemical. Well, that was in the mid 19th century, and by the turn of the 20th century, It was clearly being argued that life's processes could be reduced to chemistry, and that led to the birth of biochemistry. So this was also a great step forward. And Loeb, also from Rockefeller, stated in 1910 that you should consider the cell as a chemical machine. So how did this work? Well, it's all to do with a number of things. The macromolecules of life, important for that, are the proteins I've already described, chains of amino acids. They wrap themselves up into different shapes, and they have different surfaces. Some parts of them don't like water, some parts of them like water, some of them are negatively charged, some of them positively charged. And these different surfaces provide different microchemical environments that can break and reform chemical bonds. And that's the way I think I like you to think about it. There are different chemical microenvironments that create and destroy particular bonds. They're like the little catalysts, catalytic machines in the cell with different shapes producing different chemical transformations. So although this is clearly chemistry, I want to emphasize this is a very complex chemistry, and this is going to be an introduction to my fifth idea. On this next slide, I'm going to show you a metabolic map. Each of these little black blobs here is a particular chemical undergoing a transformation to another chemical. And you can see here how complicated all these changes are. This is only a small part of what's going on in a cell, and here we see several hundred reactions. There are several thousand reactions, if not more, going on in a cell only a couple of microns cube, all at the same time. It's extraordinary chemistry. To get even a two or three of these steps to be done industrially will require processes like the size of this room. It's all going on simultaneously in this tiny, tiny cell. Now, to understand this, we have to understand compartmentation, the generation of micro compartments, chemical compartments. Again, this is not a way that people usually think about it, but if you look at the structure of a cell, normally the emphasis is, oh, these are all a nice little structures, and you think about them just as a structure. That isn't how you should think about them. How you should think about this is that each of these structures contribute to a wide variety of different chemical environments. The organelles, that's the membrane-bound components like the nucleus and mitochondria here, provide bigger microchemical compartments, and then you go right down to the proteins that provide smaller chemical microenvironments. All of these are occurring at the same time within the cell. So this is my fourth idea. Life as chemistry provides good mechanistic explanations of life, provides the basis for understanding many diseases. In fact, most clinical research is aimed at understanding what goes wrong chemically in a disease. And as a consequence of that, it's central to medicine and the pharmaceutical industry in producing drugs that will either block certain processes or promote certain processes to correct or substitute for certain chemical deficiencies. So it's a central part of a major approach in medicine today, and has destroyed vitalism. We can now understand life's processes in terms of the laws of chemistry and physics. I've emphasized chemistry, but of course there's also a physical basis here as well. Now, what about my fifth idea? Well, my fifth idea is not one. I think the four ideas I've discussed with you up until now would be well accepted by many biologists. It's not the only ideas, it's the four that I've chosen because they're of greatest interest to me. And I'm going to finish now with my fifth idea. And if I'm making you go a little bit sleepy, don't worry, I'm nearly at the end. So one last effort of concentration and it'll be fine, okay? So one more idea. And this is to consider biology as a complex organized system, focusing on the management of information. And the key issue is to consider and understand and interpret biological phenomena in terms of the management of information. And that's going to be my fifth idea. Now, in biology, I think one of our major objectives is to try and explain what could be thought of as higher order phenomena like homeostasis, how you maintain balance, communication, organisation in space and, for that matter, in time. Sort of higher-level phenomena beyond the simple chemical reaction. Now, to do that, I think what's important here, and it's not my idea, let me stress, absolutely not my idea, it's been around for years, but I want to promote it here. What I think we have to do is to translate descriptions of the chemical and physical processes of life, of the sort that I was telling you in the last idea, into the management of information, that is the gathering of information, the storing of information, and the processing of information, which then determines subsequent outputs and can give you an explanation of these higher level phenomena. And what this sort of thinking emphasizes are concepts like regulation, networks, systems, organization, emergent behaviors, and these sorts of phenomena. Now, Francis Crick, who was probably the greatest theorist in biology in the 20th century, said when you're thinking about biology, you can follow one of three things. You can follow the matter, you can follow the energy, or you can follow the information. And the greatest of these, to go biblical, is information. And I think that's absolutely correct. Now, I'm going to illustrate this point, first of all, with two examples which will be well known, just to indicate that this isn't a new deal, and then finish with a few speculations of how this might be useful in the future. Now, the first of these ideas is the double helix. This structure, iconic for biology, the double helix, the structure of DNA. Now, this isn't beautiful because it's a beautiful structure. I mean, it is in a sense a beautiful structure. It's beautiful because of what it can tell us about the higher order phenomenon, which in this case is heredity. Now, what this really is a digitally encoded information device. And that's actually how you should view it. It's a string of nucleotides which can be exactly copied because of the complementary pairing. And the string of nucleotides form a language. It's a digital message, and it's storing information. And the point about this is that this becomes beautiful not when you just think of the angstroms and the connections of the atoms. It becomes beautiful when you translate it into information, information which underpins what we think of as heredity. And it's only when that chemical structure is expressed in terms of information storage that it makes biological sense. I mean, what I'm saying is all very obvious. I'm just trying to say it in a way which emphasizes the importance of information in understanding why DNA, the structure of DNA, is important for a biological phenomenon, in this case, heredity. Second idea. Well, the second idea is illustrated by this device here. Now, I'm always struck by the fact, you know, that we all understand machines that were built before 1900, but barely ever understand a machine that was built after 1900. I don't know if you're the same as me, but I mean, you look at this, which is a governor from a steam engine built in the 19th century, and you immediately understand how it works. I'll explain it if it isn't absolutely obvious. But, you know, you look at something I'll show you in a moment, which is a transistor circuit, and none of us understand, well, some of us understand how it works, but mere biologists don't. So what is this? This is, of course, a device that will regulate by negative feedback a steam engine. As the steam engine goes too fast, those balls swing out by centrifugal force. It closes off a valve and cuts down steam going into the engine. This is a classical negative feedback loop of the sort we see up here, which is now translated to a set of enzymatic reactions within the cell, where A is turned to B, is turned to C, and C feeds back on A to B. So when you build up C, you switch off A to B and C drops. Negative feedback giving you homeostasis, okay? So this is a negative feedback loop and was first properly applied in biology by two great French scientists, Jacob and Monod, who used it to describe the behavior of the and regulation of the lac operon, and which they explained in terms of a negative feedback loop. You could describe the protein and DNA and the RNA that that makes up the functioning of the regulation of lacoperon simply in terms of chemicals, macromolecules touching each other. You could describe it, but you would have no sense of what it meant. You only get a sense of what it means when you translate it into information and how that information is managed. That is, it generates a negative feedback loop. So once again, another simple example. I put a positive feedback loop down at the bottom, which of course leads to a switch behavior, complete opposite to homeostasis, which means once you get to C, C promotes A to B, so you have a one-directional, positive feedback gives you a switch, a one-directional way of going. So this idea of feedback circuits and connections into networks, you can see here in a metaphor of an electronic circuit. And the electronic circuit, somewhere I stole this from a journal, the different transistors and so on have been replaced with names of genes, in this case important for cancer, to introduce a notion that you can consider biological networks in the same way as an electronic circuit, where an electronic circuit acts as a metaphor. And Dennis Bray has recently written a book which might interest some of you called Wetware, where he makes comparisons between cells and computer hardware, but uses, coins a term, quite a nice term, of wetware, because instead of there being hardware connections between the different components, they're connected by diffusing chemicals going from one component to another, which has another interesting property, of course, which is different from a normal network of this sort. This network is fixed and you have to play around with connections with the software, right? But of course in wetware, you reconnect the hardware in all sorts of ways. So you have an extra richness of behavior because you can play with the hardware as well as how that hardware is actually operating. So what I'm arguing here is that we need to consider the cell, and I would start with the cell as the basic unit of life, as a complex chemical system acting as a logical computational machine of linked logical modules. And I'm just going to finish now with a couple of examples of how that thinking will help us in understanding biological phenomena. First thing I want to emphasize is that we need help from others, and I'm going to end with that in a moment, because these ideas are not confined just to biology. Networks, for example, I've just had to suffer a network to get here from New York. And networks, this is an efficient way this is obviously an airline network, and what you conclude looking at this is that Houston is much more important than Kansas City. Now, it may be much more important than Kansas City, but what I'm trying to say here is take out Houston and the whole thing collapses, take out Kansas City and nobody really cares very much because you're not going anywhere, it's not well connected. And the phenomena of connections has been well thought about in many systems, including transport networks, and is absolutely relevant to biology too, where there are hubs of highly linked components that are crucial for decision making. Now, second point I want to say about networks. We tend in biology, in fact it reflects human thinking, I'll come to that in a moment, to think in linear pathways. You know, we like to think, you know, we have certain sort of philosophical and logical sense of causality and we represent it with such arrows. And so we try to reduce what we do to these sorts of pathways. The reality is something like this. Much more complex, redundancy, steps going forwards and backwards, positive feedback loops, negative feedback loops, so that this becomes a much more complex network. We know that if we turn this off or up or down, that will turn this up or down, or at least most of the time we will, depending on how they're set up. But if we turn this off, what does it do? We can't get it in intuitively. We have got to start working and thinking much more like this rather than this. I'm now going to show you a scurrilous slide that I stole from a pilot's handbook. I'm a recreational pilot. So this is it. We have to think less like men who think like this and more like women in a more complex way who reflect this. Okay? And if we can think in this more complex way, we're going to be much more successful, I think, in thinking about biological systems. Some people give me a hard time when I say that, I have to say. So I'm going to move on very fast. Now, another point I want to say about networks. Now, this is, again, how we tend to think about things. And if you're thinking of communicating information from the left to the right, in this pathway here, you only have an option of being on or off. It's like a traffic light. You can be on or off. You either have a signal or you don't. Now, do something slightly more sophisticated. Imagine, put dynamics in this, put time into this. In other words, don't just imagine it's on or off, but imagine it can be on for a time and off for a time. Okay? Now, that introduces dynamics, so that the same pathway can communicate a signal which says this versus one that says this. These are different messages. These are different messages. Now, what I'm going to show you in the next slide is a metaphor, but will illustrate it well, I think. Because when you have an on-off switch, it's like a traffic light. If you introduce dynamics, you generate the Morse code. Once you've generated the Morse code, you can write the works of Shakespeare. In other words, introducing dynamics moves you from very, very simple communication to a much more, potentially, a much more complex communication of information. Now, we're only just scratching the surface here, but I will be astonished if biology does not use dynamics in the networks that have been identified to communicate much more information. Because biology is very clever and sort of most things that we have thought of before us. And I'm sure that as we are now increasingly able to analyze dynamics, that that's going to be important. We have to understand how these networks generate organization in space. This is a very simple structure, which is just self-assembly. I'm much more interested in how you generate regulated spatial organization, say over a cell or an organism. And that's going to involve thinking like the Turing equation, the reaction diffusion model that some of you may be familiar with. One final point in thinking about biology networks and how it works. Biology is not intelligently designed. I'll say it again, it's not intelligently designed. Harrison's clocks were intelligently designed, and I'm going to point out the difference. John Harrison was the 18th century clockmaker who was trying to win a prize from the British Admiralty for a very accurate timepiece to measure longitude. Darvis Bell has written a very nice book if you want to read about it. The Admiralty were very mean and didn't want to award him the prize until he got it very, very accurate. He first of all produced this clock and it didn't work quite well enough, okay? So he then threw it away and designed another one that looked like this, okay? Then he threw that away and designed another one, and then finally, 30 years after this one, built this one, which has no resemblance to the first clock. There is no way this could happen by evolution, by natural selection. It happened by design. He looked at this, intelligently thought about it, and redesigned this. We are a product, and all living organisms, of natural selection, working on what existed before. So we have all this redundancy with us, you know, just like our appendix. And we have all this stuff there, and we shouldn't think that it's going to be an intelligently designed network of the sort that, say, physicists like. It won't be like it. It'll be a mess. There will be redundancy. It won't work terribly well. It's never going to be beautiful in the structure of it because of the way that it's come about. And that means it's going to be redundant and more complex than we would like to think. I think that this is going to be very interesting to apply these sorts of ideas, and I really want to end with one further point about it, because of the complexity involved here, I have a feeling that biology may become more increasingly sort of counterintuitive. I'm an experimental biologist, and I still use common sense in most things that I do. So when I study a cell, I sort of imagine this room as a cell, and I have something over there interacting with something over here. It's all in a common sense world of three dimensions of space and time. But this sort of complexity that I've been describing moves us away from that sort of common sense approach. Now, I can remind you that a move away from the common sense occurred in physics too. Everybody understands physics more or less up to 1900 or thereabouts, you know, Newtonian physics. Then we get relativity and you get a little sort of uncertain, you know, you read it, you think you've got it, and it starts slipping away. You know, you close the book, you had a common sense picture of it, and it slips away from you. You know, you don't quite get it. And if you think you've got trouble with relativity, let's go 20 years later and end up with quantum mechanics, and I defy nearly everyone in the room, maybe not quite everyone in the room, but nearly everyone in the room, to truly understand it in a common sense sort of way. You end up in Schrodinger's cats. I mean, it is just not possible to have a common sense picture of the world. It's sort of it makes sense in the mathematics, it makes sense in the abstraction, it doesn't make sense in a common sense world. I only became convinced of this when my daughter, who is a high energy physicist, and she said she didn't understand it in that way either. She only understood it in terms of the equations. I suspect biology will go more in that direction. I think we need much help from the theorists of the same discipline and training that physics gives biologists to be able to deal with that complexity. So we may be moving from a more common sense world to a stranger world of a new biology. So my great ideas, I put the great ideas up there, I thought I'd expunged the, but I missed it here. The cell, the gene, evolution by natural selection, life as chemistry, I think are four ideas that many would accept. Biology as an organized system, emphasizing the management of information, I think is one with great promise for the future. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Paul. That really was magnificent. But you're not over yet. We have questions we have an audience that sometimes asks questions for quite a while. We'll try to keep it reasonable, and afterwards, as always, there's refreshments in the commons room. So let me start out by asking a question. Since you
and I'm a bit deaf, so if I have trouble getting it, can you repeat it for me?
If you and anyone who wants to ask a question, wait for the microphone. So of course we record it. Since you are referring to the great idea,
I did on this time. It's a mistake. Sorry.
So I was trying to think of what's missing, of course, and the one thing that's missing is mind is matter, or mind is the brain. And thinking about that is interesting, because their information obviously is key, but it's distributed.
Yeah.
Very different than the cell or these ideas. So do you agree that that's a missing great idea?
Well, I think mind is clearly another great problem. I'm not sure we yet have a great idea to explain that problem, but it is absolutely clear that what you just said is right. The only way we're going to understand it is in terms of information. That's the only way we're going to make sense about it. And it will be more complex in the ways you've said than the cell, but I'd rather cut my teeth on the cell before mind. I think ecology is something else I'd throw in here, and ecological networks. I didn't talk about that. I'd have probably taken that on next. But once again, that's an issue of management of information. So if I was giving several of these talks, I would have actually expanded this information idea to permeate these other issues, the issues of mind and also ecology as networks, because I think that there's going to be a lot of crosstalk from in thinking of management of information and systems across the whole realm of biology. But I do think the mind is really tough, and I'm keeping with the cell because I like the art of the soluble, and I think we might make progress there. The mind's beyond me. Good.
So now we're open. Wait for a microphone.
Please.
I was very interested in your talking about protein occurring in both the physical structure as well as the chemistry within the cell. And can we conclude that that protein is derived from the foodstuffs we eat?
Well, everything is derived from what we or what any living organism ingresses. And of course, many of our foodstuffs are proteins, but the way that we deal with them is to break them down to their constituents, which is individual amino acids, and then rebuild them into proteins that are of interest to us. So we don't sort of assimilate the proteins we eat. We break them down and then reform them into something else that we want. So absolutely, what you eat is important, but not specifically for that component most of the time, more because you can break them down and make what you want.
What do you think of the astrobiologists that are trying to find life in molecular forms?
Well, I think astrobiology has got to be very, very exciting. If we could discover life on some other system, on another solar system, Investigating it would be very difficult. But, I mean, the experiment that you would have there, two differently evolved systems, would be wonderful. Now, what's interesting here, though, is the only way we can easily detect life somewhere else is to rely on the chemistry of that life and how our experience of life on this planet disturbs the geology of the planet that we might be able to observe on a distant solar system. Now we know, it's one of the great discoveries of astronomy of the last decade or so, that there are many planets around other stars. There will be many solar systems, so there's going to be potential for finding other life. But of course, it is possible to have life which isn't based on our chemistry, that is to say, the chemistry of carbon, nitrogen and oxygen that we have, carbon-based essentially. And there have been proposals of living systems defined in the way that Muller defined it, as a system that will evolve by natural selection, that are not based on carbon, but are based, for example, on silicon and on clay particles. So it's possible, though difficult for us to conceive, that maybe there are other life forms that have a completely different chemistry. And how one could actually detect those, not by traditional chemistry, I'm not really quite sure, and that would be particularly exciting. But we may not even have to go to other planets. It is possible that there's other life forms which are around us or deep in the Earth, but because we're not asking the right questions, looking for the right signature, if you like, of life, we haven't seen it. You know, if it operates in a different way, we may not have seen it. Now, I don't think that's likely on the surface here, where the competition with our form of life, which I think would be rather difficult, that's likely to be the case. But who knows what's 1,000 kilometres underneath the Earth's surface? So it may be one should be thinking about this much closer to home too. So I think it's really interesting, really important, but maybe we don't have to go out to the stars. Maybe we go deep under the Earth.
So thank you for the talk. I guess it's a fairly grandiose topic, so there's a fairly grandiose question. So what is life? And by that I mean, give us the criteria that you would use to judge something as a living system.
To define life?
Yeah, and I can give you an example where probably most people disagree with me, which is like, I think computer viruses in almost every way you could probably delineate are actually living things.
Yeah. Well, you know, trying to define life is like trying to define science, I have to say. I mean, it seems we ought to be able to do it easily, and then when you're trying to do it, it isn't so easy. The definition Muller gave would apply to the situation that you just described, because you can get they will undergo evolution. However, they are parasitic upon another system. They're not self-contained, in the sense that a free living organism, and I think there's a sort of concept in here that I can't explain in a nice way, but a free living organism which is simply surrounded by simple nutrients, low molecular weight stuff, can actually generate everything it can, whereas your computer virus isn't able to do that. So I would put into the idea the concept not only the ability to evolve and by natural selection, but an ability to maintain yourself in an environment of very simple components. And but then you could come back at me. You see, we don't do too well bathing, you know, glucose and phosphate. So we have to rely on more complex systems. So maybe we are more like your computer virus than the yeast I study. So I do understand it's a messy question and a good one, but I wouldn't agree with you, but I can't explain very well why I don't.
Would the principle of self-organization be a candidate for your list?
Yeah, well, self-organization it sort of comes out in the sort of, you know, the fifth idea, really. I didn't sort of emphasize it, but the ability to generate higher level order from simpler principles and self... a good metaphor, in case people don't know quite what we're talking about here, if you look at a flock of birds, they seem to have a higher order structure, which is actually built out of rather simple rules. And I think that's very crucial here too. So I think that's an important part of thinking about how these complex systems work.
If we were to imagine some sort of advanced life, by advanced I mean, you know, above cell level, say, on other planets and other solar systems, would you expect these same great ideas of biology to emerge from that?
From what sort of cells?
Well, any sort of advanced life on another planet, if it were to be discovered, would you expect these same sorts of ideas, you know, around some sort of cell and some sort of transmission of information by a gene and a mechanism to select and chemistry and so forth? Would you expect those same ideas to emerge out of that discovery?
I think we may have to transform, I think, the principles here, which I'll now state differently, rather than the names are important. So a cell implies a bounded entity, okay? A gene implies a element of heredity. Evolution by natural selection, I'm taking the Muller definition, so we'd have that. And life as chemistry, it might be a different sort of chemistry and physics, I mean not a different sort, not based on the same molecules, but it's got to have a mechanistic basis. And the fifth one is that it's a complex system involving information. I think all would apply, it may not look the same sort of thing, but an abstraction of the concept, I think, would be the same. So I think the answer is yes, but I have to change the language somewhat.
So I was very struck by your diagram that showed a linear analysis, little arrows going,
and
then a complex system.
Yeah.
Because it seems to me that we can all intuitively understand how you analyze and try and decode a linear progression. But an organized system is so much more complex. It seems to me that you need completely different analytical tools that maybe are much more statistical and mathematical and less the way we normally think of biology. But it seems to me it requires a paradigm shift to begin to analyze those systems, because you can no longer break it down to the little step-by-step processes, because too many things are happening all at once that feed back on one another and, you know, to several orders of magnitude. So how do you begin to analyze these complex, almost chaotic systems?
Well, the first thing is I'm going to steal every word you said, because I think you stated it very nicely. I agree with everything you said. I think it does require different tools, which is why I ended with the statement we need help, and I think from theorists, particularly those trained in the physical sciences, who are more comfortable with the sort of abstraction and thinking mathematically or logically than my discipline. And I think we need to work together to bring our different strengths to bear on this problem. And that doesn't mean I know where we should go, because I actually don't. But I think that's what we require. I think we require these different disciplines to help us. I do think that this point I was making, that we will move from, I think this is what you were implying, we will move from a common sense world into a stranger world. And, you know, our common sense, like Kant, you know, we evolved to think in three dimensions of space and time and to think in terms of linear causality. That's what we're comfortable with, because it made us succeed. You know, if you were a hunter-gatherer trying to catch a deer or something, you probably don't want to get tangled up in a complex network, you know? I mean, it probably wouldn't help you very much. It's more straightforward to have a linear causality, like I throw the spear and I kill the deer. I mean, you don't want to get distracted by it, but we're now in a more comfortable life, let's say, and we can afford You know, we can afford to be more abstract. So I think it's the way to go. I don't quite know how to do it, and I know we need help, but I think it will be very interesting, maybe even very exciting to do it.
I think I'm going to end with one question I'd like to ask you, especially in response to that last. And this is, of course, an area where there's lots of debate within biology and among people like who are attracted to biology from physics. Are there universals? So if it sounds like you are one who might agree, who might believe that there might be universal characteristics to life as you defined it, satisfies these definitions and works according to these processes, as opposed to contrary point of view that all the life we observe around us and that we can investigate experimentally is a product of a particular accidental history of natural selection without universal characteristics that would enable this approach that you're sort of getting to be powerfully successful. So what do you believe on this
right
subject?
Well, I'm going to say I think it's in the direct, I think it is an attempt at answering your question. I think, I don't think everything is a happy accident. I think that life forms are moved to different places in phase space by selection, but that the stable places in phase space are limited, if I can put it that way. In other words, some biologists think that every space can be occupied. You can move to every little point in this room, and you get there by evolution, by natural selection. I think that there are only a few places in this room which have stable, let's call them attractors, stable positions, and that what natural selection does is move you from here to there and not here to there. And the properties that generate the stable systems are reflected in here. In other words, there will only be certain characteristics that are possible to generate stable systems, and that will be in some ways quite trivial, like, you know, we're not going to be able to easily inhabit a 500 degrees centigrade place because it will fall apart. But more interestingly, I suspect there's only limited sets of systems that will work too. And I feel there will be laws and principles that will eventually emerge in the coming century that will define what those stable components are. And I think that will be a key part of this information management and organized system, because it will be defining those parts which are stable, which will be part of generating the rule book. That's my intuition about it. I think we have to think about it and see where we go to know whether that's right. But I suspect it's the same position as you, in fact.
Okay, let's thank Paul again for one.
Good.